නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස Actually we have completed Vatthupama Sutta which is the 7th sutta in Majjhima Nikaya and today I thought of starting a new sutta since we have discussed in length about various defilements imperfections in the mind so I thought of little change the topic and thought of starting this interesting sutta which is called the Nagaropama Sutta so it's a simile of the fortress or simile of the protected city and so here Buddha actually takes a interesting simile that is a king's fortress and he give an account of interesting features there some protective measures that the king has taken in order to protect the fortress from enemies and to make sure it is really strong safe and those key features Buddha first explain and then he similarly explain what are the qualities that a practitioner may have to have and there he do a very interesting comparison between the king's fortress and one's these qualities that one is developing so the first part of the sutta is very much the account of various features that the fortress have So we'll go through that from the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. Because when a king's frontier fortress is well provided with 7 appurtenances of a fortress and readily gains without trouble or difficulty 4 kinds of food, it can be called a king's frontier fortress that cannot be assailed by external force and enemies. So basically there are 4 kinds of food and as well as certain appurtenances. I don't know what's the English term for that. What is appurtenances? So interesting term, there are appurtenances. Give me a second. So it translates as... something subordinate to or belonging to another larger principal entity that is an adjunct satellite or accessory that generally accompanies something else usage seems like kind of a important improvement belonging to or that accompanies a principal property maybe kind of an adjacent kind of supporting structure maybe certain supporting structures which is helping the safeguard or the protection of the kingdom so we can say like that and then further Buddha mentioned what are the 7 kinds of appurtenances of a fortress with which it is well provided now Buddha going to explain those 7 kind of we can say kind of facilities special components which are safeguarding the whole fortress so number 1 here bhikkhus in the king's frontier fortress the pillar has a deep base and is securely planted immobile unshakable a king's frontier fortress is well provided with this first appurtenances for protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders Now this is called the Inda Keela. So here the Pali term Katamehi Sattahi Nagara Parikkarehi Saparikkhatam Hoti. So Nagara Parikkarehi is what Bhikkhu Bodhi has translated as appurtenance. So that means certain components, certain parts of a particular fortress. So which is actually supporting the well-being or the well-protection of the fortress. And number 1 is Esika. So that is the Esika is a kind of a very powerful or very strong kind of a pillar that is being kept in the middle of the fortress. So to that, actually, all the other doors and everything is sort of bound, and it's a kind of a protective mechanism in the all kingdoms that the people have used. And so if that is well grounded and it is immovable, or it is very strong and steady, so that assures the protection of all the doors. Now there are various entrances to the fortress, and all those entrances are well protected if this esika, or what we call as this the pillar, has a deep base. So it is immobile, and again it is well securely planted on the ground. So that is called number one. And then number two, again in the king's frontier fortress, the moat is dug deep and wide. A king's frontier fortress is well provided with this second appurtenance for protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders. So that is called Gambira Cheva Vittatta Cha Imina Dutiena Nagara Parikkerena Suparikkatan Hoti. Now there is a second one, so that is called moat. What is the moat?
Like around the kuti, there is the kumbi.
Ah, I see. Kind of a canal kind of thing.
Yes.
Oh, okay. So in Pali, it is called nagare. Bikave ranyo pachanti me nagare parikha hoti gambhira cheva vittata cha. Imina dutiyena nagara parikkarena suparikkatan hoti. So there's a kind of agala in Sinhala, where kind of a canal being completely dug around the fortress. So if anyone have to come to the fortress, they have to cross that dug, deep, which is deep and wide. So easily then one can notice. So that is also there. So that is the second item they have prepared for the protection of the fortress. The number three, again in the king's frontier fortress, the patrol path is high and wide. A king's frontier fortress is well provided with this third appurtenance for protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders. Now there is a path through which the soldiers and all these people are going through, and that is also well prepared, and they can easily go through that so that they can check the whole area. So that is also another area or another component of this fortress.
So did you say the path is long?
It's called path is high and wide.
High
and wide. It is mentioned high and wide. So uccho cheva vittato cha. So that is what in Pali it is mentioned. Anupariya patho. So there's a kind of a path prepared all around the fortress. So through that, the soldiers can move around and they can inspect the whole fortress. So therefore it is wide and it may be little high so that they can see the whole around, surrounding.
On top of the wall.
Maybe something like that.
Seen that.
Ah, maybe. On top of the wall.
Can look
around.
See if anybody's coming.
Yeah, so the wall is fairly wide and therefore they can walk on top of the wall and they can see what is really going on. So that is number three. And then number four, again in the king's frontier fortress, many weapons are stored, both missiles and hand weapons. A king's frontier fortress is well provided with this fourth appurtenance for protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders. So then abudham, so that is the various different kinds of weapons are kept to safeguard the fortress, and that is also another number four protection given for the fortress. Then number five, again in the king's frontier fortress, many kinds of troops reside. That is elephant troops, cavalry, charioteers, archers, standard bearers, then camp marshals, foot servers, Ugga caste warriors, frontline commandos, great bull warriors, attack soldiers, shield-bearing soldiers, domestic slave soldiers. A king's frontier fortress is well provided with this fifth appurtenance for protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders. Now here it is talking about various kinds of armies, and so that is another thing. So it is well protected by different skill developed armies, and one is capable of handling archers and some charioteers, some elephants. So in the good old days, so these are the different kinds of armies that they are talking, and so everything is there, so well protected. The number six, again in the frontier fortress, the gatekeeper is wise, competent and intelligent, one who keeps out strangers and admits acquaintances. A king's frontier fortress is well provided with this sixth appurtenance for protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders. Now there is a gatekeeper. Now gatekeeper is a very wise person. He has a very good memory also. Intelligent guy. And he actually know who is the kind of person that need to be allowed to come in and who should not be allowed to come in. So he's an intelligent and competent person. So he is the gatekeeper. So that is in Pali called Dwariko. Nagare Dwariko hoti pandito bayat vyatto medhavi. So that means a very intelligent person, and again he is a capable person, and it's a wise person. So he is the one who is allowing the people to come in and who is not allowing the force and say the disguised people not to come in. The number seven, again in the king's frontier fortress, the rampart is high and wide, covered over by a coat of plaster. A king's frontier fortress is well provided with this seventh appurtenance for protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders. So Pakaro, now this is the wall. Now there's a high and wide rampart. It's a wall, right? So that's the large wall which is very high and again wide. And that is also giving the protection to the fortress. And it is well provided with these seven kinds of appurtenances. And what are the four kinds of food that is readily gains without trouble or difficulty? Now all these protections are given, but the inhabitants also have to have enough food. Now Buddha mentioned there are four kinds of foods available. Here bhikkhus in the king's frontier fortress, much grass, firewood and water are stored up for the delight, relief and ease of its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders. So that means grass, firewood, water. So that means they are used for the cooking. So whatever necessary for cooking, so all the ingredients, all the necessary equipment are available. That is number one. Again, in the king's frontier fortress, much rice and barley are stored up for the delight, relief and ease of its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders. Now, enough dry grains are also there. So grains in their dry form, they are also enough available so that anytime they can cook what is necessary. That is number two. Then number three, again in the king's frontier fortress, many foodstuffs, sesame, green gram and beans are stored up for the delight, relief and ease of its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders. Now other grains are also there, so that basically gives a count of staple food, so people can prepare enough staple food using these different grains. Then number four, again in the king's frontier fortress, many medicaments, ghee, butter, oil, honey, molasses and salt are stored up for the delight, relief and ease of its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders. Now other nutriments are also there, and that is also mentioned. Number Now, these are the four foods that is readily gains without trouble or difficulty. Now, further Buddha mentioned, when bhikkhus, a king's frontier fortress is well provided with these seven appurtenances of a fortress, and it is when it readily gains without trouble or difficulty these four kinds of food, it can be said that the king's frontier fortress cannot be assailed by external force and enemies. Now they are keeping in guard, so all the necessary facilities are given, the components are available, so the fortress is well protected. And at the same time, the inhabitants are given enough food and all other facilities so that they are well protected and they can live there quite easily, comfortably. Now Buddha goes on to connect the whole simile to the practice. So too, bhikkhus, when a noble disciple possesses seven good qualities. Now here Buddha talks about seven good qualities. Seven good qualities. And when he gains at will, without trouble or difficulty, the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and are pleasant dwellings in this very life, he is then called a noble disciple who cannot be assailed by Mara, who cannot be assailed by the evil one. Now, here we can say there are seven kinds of good qualities. Now Buddha going to explain, which are similar to the seven kinds of appurtenances available for a fortress. And again, the four foods which we were discussed are Buddha very much parallelly equalizing to these four jhanas. If those things are available, Buddha mentioned, so this particular practitioner, monk or nun or layperson, cannot be assailed by the Mara. So that means his mind is well protected. So what are the important good qualities that Buddha is talking here? Now these are the things that we need to pay more attention, because as practitioners in this sutta, Buddha gives an account of these different qualities that we need to have. Just as because the pillar in the king's frontier fortress has a deep base and is securely planted, immobile and unshakable for the purpose of protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders. So too, the noble disciple is endowed with faith. Now here, faith is similar to that. He places faith in the enlightenment of the Tathagata. Thus, the Blessed One is an Arahant, perfectly enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed trainer of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas and humans, the Enlightened One, the Blessed One. With faith as his pillar, the noble disciple abandons the unwholesome and develops the wholesome, abandons what is blameworthy and develops what is blameless, and maintains himself in purity. He possesses this first good quality. Now the first good quality is therefore the faith. Now you can see Buddha starts with faith. So if one has firm faith, unwavering kind of faith, now you can see it was sort of metaphorically mentioned or connected to a securely planted, immobile, unshakable and deeply based kind of a pillar. So you can see what are the indications in a deeply planted, immobile, unshakable pillar. So Buddha mentioned similarly one has to have the faith. So the one's faith has to be then very well strong, well planted, immobile and it has to be very well planted, immobile and unshakable. So sometimes our faith wavers. So sometimes we question and sometimes we don't have proper faith on the Buddha and maybe on the Dhamma, maybe on the Sangha. So that basically indicates that the mind is not well protected, as the fortress is not well protected. If that particular pillar is kind of shakable and mobile, and it is kind of weak, then of course the other, say, attached doors and whatever the openings may be in trouble because the pillar is not strong. So similarly, Buddha mentioned, if the disciple has strong faith, then he is well protected because he has kind of immovable faith. He has an unshakable faith. So he believes that the Buddha is an arahant. So Buddha is a perfect one. So he has perfectly enlightened. So he is the shova of the path. So likewise, all these good qualities that we typically mention in this in the Buddha's qualities. So if one has proper kind of faith on Buddha, so then he is basically having unwavering kind of faith. So sometimes the path would be difficult, sometimes we can't get quick results and we may encounter various obstacles, but in the meantime, if we have strong faith, then that is kind of a protection. Because even though all these difficulties arise, actually one maintains one's faith on Buddha. As a result of that, one is capable of continuing the path. So that is number one, faith. Then number two, just as the moat in the king's frontier fortress is dug deep and wide for the purpose of protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders, so too a noble disciple has a sense of moral shame. So moral shame is considered as a moat. He is ashamed of bodily, verbal and mental misconduct. He is ashamed of acquiring bad, unwholesome qualities. With a sense of moral shame as the moat, the noble disciple abandons the unwholesome and develops the wholesome, abandons what is blameworthy and develops what is blameless, and maintains himself in purity. He possesses this second good quality. So there Buddha mentioned, Gambhira Cheva Vittata. So that is Nagara Parikha Hoti Gambhi Siyatavi Bhikkave Ranyo Pachantime Nagare Parikha Parikha Hoti Gambhira Cheva Vittata Cha Abhantarang Guttiya Bahiranang Patigahataya Eva Mevanko Bhikkave Aryasavako Hirima Hoti Hiriyati Kaya Duccharitang Vachi Duccharitang Mano Duccharitang Hiriyati papakanam akusalanam dhammam samapattiya. So basically hirima hoti. So hirima means the moral shame. So the second quality Buddha emphasized is the moral shame. So nowadays actually people don't have moral shame. So that's why so much of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying and all these things, they are not ashamed of doing any unwholesome deed, either through the body, through words, or through mind. So they are kind of shameless. What Buddha preach or admonish for his followers is that you should be kind of endowed with sense of moral shame. So don't do the unwholesome deeds. So whenever there is something, say you got to, suppose that you are in a little trouble, economically you are weak, do you have moral shame to avoid any kind of stealing? Or are we also trapped in the how others are doing? So when someone else is stealing and when someone else is cheating, so we also sometimes question, if he is doing, why don't I do it? So that is how people are more and more neglectful about their moral shame, and they also start stealing, they also start cheating and involved with various frauds and etc. But if you are endowed with this moral shame, even though others don't have moral shame, even though others are involved with various misconduct, if you are strongly maintaining moral shame, then that is a protection for you. So basically nowadays, so these things are not well explained, even not well appreciated, because people are more thinking about how somehow earning money. So that's their only target, and they don't have any moral shame. Suppose that you are doing some sort of a business. So is it really a valid business? It is kind of a moral kind of a business. Or are we simply neglecting all those moral aspects or all those ethical aspects? So all this moral shame, and again the next one is the moral dread, is actually helping us to look the big picture. Suppose if you are not seeing the big picture, actually we can get quick results or quick gains and quick fames, and one can quickly become a rich person, neglecting the moral shame and moral dread. But it is very short-lived, and we should not think this whole wandering in the samsara only to this life. Sometimes we forget to see the big picture. We don't understand the consequences. We only see the short-term benefits, neglecting about the long-term consequences. So that is where sometimes people are quite neglectful. So they simply find out the easy methods, neglecting all ethics, neglecting all virtues, and forgetting about moral shame and moral dread. So they do the easy things, somehow earn money, and that is how they think that they can become rich, wealthy. But here Buddha mentioned his disciple, like a frontier fortress has kind of a moat, which is well prepared, well dug deep, like that one has to have moral shame. And when a particular task is about to conduct, then one should be easily noticing that. Okay, mind is suggesting something. Suppose that you are quite sort of hungry, and there are sort of animals that you can kill and eat, and there's a kind of a temptation coming from inside. But if you have moral shame, probably you may not implement that. And the next part also we can connect to that. So just as the petrol path in the king's frontier fortress is high and wide, similarly Buddha mentioned for the protecting of the inhabitants, so too a noble disciple dreads wrongdoing. Now this moral dread, so he don't want to do that. So basically it is not that someone else is looking at you. It is not that someone is sort of connected to CCTV or something like that. Rather, internally one feels moral shame. Internally one feels moral dread. So sometimes, so this lajja bhaya, hiriyottappa, is considered as the whole governing principle of the whole world. But nowadays, I mean, we have completely forgotten this, and people are completely neglectful about moral shame and moral dread, and they simply behave as they wish, and neglecting all these principles. But here Buddha mentioned a noble disciple dreads wrongdoing. He dreads bodily, verbal and mental misconduct. He dreads acquiring bad, unwholesome qualities. With moral dread as the patrol path, the noble disciple abandons the unwholesome and develops the wholesome. Abandons what is blameworthy and develops what is blameless, and maintains himself in purity. He possesses this third good quality. Now, another interesting thing is that suppose there's a defilement arising in the mind, and probably the mindfulness has indicated that, because when you are developing mindfulness, satipatthana, so always the awareness of the mind starts developing. So whenever a kind of a defilement arises in the mind, so immediately you may notice that, okay, there's a lustful thought. If we don't have moral shame, if we don't have moral dread, because of the delight we get through the lustful thought, probably we may even allow it to stay in the mind without applying any kind of a proper method to abandon that. We simply start enjoying lust, enjoying various sexual fantasies, because we don't have moral shame and moral dread. Enough moral shame and moral dread is not developed. As a result of that, even though mindfulness has shown us, okay, now a lustful thought has arisen, you still start, keep entertaining that, keep sort of even developing that, keep sort of having delight with that, because you don't have moral shame, you don't have moral dread, and we are neglectful in that sense. We are not very much attuned towards kind of a more pure sort of life. We allow the mind to be colored, or we allow the mind to be very much become kind of dirty through these lustful thoughts, because there is a delight available in that. So we are being tempted to that delight, allow the mind to be fully overwhelmed by lust, even though still we have the facility, or even though we have the capacity to overcome that lust. Say for example, if you are developing mindfulness, so easily you can notice the lustful thought when it is available or arising. But if we don't have moral shame and moral dread, we simply allow the mind to continue thinking that, because there's a certain delight available through that. So that is something kind of very practical here with the talks, and we are therefore have to have some sort of an inclination to maintain a pure mind. And we should be afraid of allowing the mind to be polluted, allowing the mind to be kind of impure. So how to maintain a pure mind? So that our inclination through moral dread, through moral shame, has to be indicating kind of a more pure form of mind. So that is Buddha mentioned here. So that is where the abandons what is blameworthy and develops what is blameless, and maintains himself in purity. So maintains himself in purity. Now here Buddha very much like indicating or even kind of encouraging his disciples to turn towards the purity. While all others are going after all these impure things, here Buddha encourages his followers to go in the pure form of mentality. And then, now that is called Ottappati. Then number four, just as many weapons, both missiles and hand weapons, are stored in King's frontier fortress for the purpose of protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders, so too a noble disciple has learned much. So they are the weapons. So you are learned the Buddha's teaching. So you are a Bahusutta, remembers what he has learned and accumulates what he has learned. Those teachings that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, which proclaim the perfectly complete and pure spiritual life, such teachings as these he has learned much, retained in mind, recited verbally, mentally investigated, and penetrated well by view, with learnings as his weaponry. The noble disciple abandons the unwholesome and develops the wholesome, abandons what is blameworthy and develops what is blameless, and maintains himself in purity. He possesses this fourth good quality. Now here we can say learning as his weaponry. Now learning is used for what? Learning is used to remove what is blameless and to maintain himself in purity. Not that the learnedness or the learning is used to develop further defilements. Rather, learning is used to abandon defilements. So here Buddha mentioned in the if we refer in the Pali, so Buddha mentioned Arya Savako Bahusuto Hoti, and so he is Bahusuta, so he has learned Buddha's teaching well, and so that teaching what he has learned, now he is using to abandon various defilements rather than making any kind of a conceit or kind of being proud about that he has learned. Rather, he is using this teaching, what he has learned, to abandon defilements. Then number 5. Just as many kinds of troops reside in the king's frontier fortress, that is elephant troops, etc., etc., so we already discussed that, domestic slave soldiers, for protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders, so too, a noble disciple has aroused energy. Now he has energy for abandoning unwholesome qualities and acquiring wholesome qualities. He is strong, firm in exertion, not casting off the duty of cultivating wholesome qualities. With energy as its his troops, the noble disciple abandons unwholesome and develops wholesome. Abandon what is blameworthy and develops what is blameless, and maintains himself in purity. He possesses this fifth good quality. Now that is the energy. So the energy is energy, that means a virya, is considered as a kind of a troop. So with that troop, one is capable of fighting with all the different kinds of enemies. So he is relentless. He has relentless effort. The noble disciple has relentless effort. So he does not stop till the mind is fully purified. That's why very interesting terms are there. Akusalam pajahati, kusalam bhaveti, savajjam pajahati, anavajjam bhaveti. So sayyatavi bhikkhave ranyo pachyantime nagare bahubala kayo pativasati. Sayyatidang hatta roha, so etc. etc. So different these things there. So here, Eyomevam ko bhikkhave arya savako araddha viriyo viharati. Araddha viriyo viharati. So basically he is endowed with energy. So he always has energy. Okay, whenever unwholesome quality arises in the mind, so he is fighting against it. So it doesn't mean that he is kind of suppressing them, that we have discussed already. What are the methods available to abandon defilements? And as one is continuing in one's practice, so one become more and more capable in doing that. And he may use various qualities like wisdom, mindfulness, etc. to abandon various defilements. So now he is having the Araddha Vidya, always kind of having the effort. So whenever he wants, he can abandon defilements. Akusalanam dhammanam pahanaya, kusalanam dhammanam upasampadaya. And not only that, he has effort to arouse or further develop the necessary qualities. Because sometimes when the mind is endowed with various defilements, just abandoning them is one part. But how about having the opposite qualities? So how about having the wholesome qualities? When the wholesome qualities are more powerful, so they prevent unwholesome qualities coming in. So that is why even in the previous sutta, what we call the Vattupama Sutta, Buddha explained that so one is developing loving kindness, one is developing compassion, altruistic joy and equanimity to the level of the complete freedom of mind. So that means a very higher level. So all these indicates that one is very much like in strengthening one's mind with the good qualities. So when the mind is strengthened with good qualities, so the unwholesome qualities find incapable of coming in. So they may not intrude to the mind because the mind is well protected with these good qualities. So here in the fifth quality, Buddha mentioned that he has energy as his troops. So using that energy, he is strong, firm in exertion and not casting off the duty of cultivating wholesome qualities. Now he hasn't stopped. He don't think now he has completed the task. Rather, he arouses energy and using that, he can constantly continue the path. Thamava dhalla parakkamo anikitta duro. Anikitta duro kusalesu dhammesu. So anikitta duro kusalesu dhammesu means, so he never sort of abandons developing the path. He do not give up. He continues, even though the difficulties are there. So till he achieves what is necessary, he is continuing. Anikitta duro kusalesu dhammesu. Then number 6. Now this is very interesting. Just as the gatekeeper in the king's frontier fortress is wise, competent and intelligent, one who keeps out strangers and admits acquaintances for protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders, so too a noble disciple is mindful. Possessing supreme mindfulness and alertness, one who remembers and recollects what was done and said long ago, with mindfulness as his gatekeeper, the noble disciple abandons the unwholesome and develops the wholesome, abandons what is blameworthy and develops what is blameless, and maintains himself in purity. He possesses this sixth good quality. So the mindfulness is therefore similar to a gatekeeper. But this gatekeeper is a wise gatekeeper, and he is quite intelligent, competent, and he can remember who are the stranger, who are the inhabitant. So he has a very good memory. So all these qualities attributed to a good gatekeeper, Buddha attributes to mindfulness. So the mindfulness has those qualities. So here we can say, Arya Savako Sati Mahoti Paramena Sati Nepakkena Samannagato Chirakatampi Chirabhasitampi Sarita Anusarita. So that means Paramena Sati Nepakkena Samannagato. So he is endowed with supreme kind of mindfulness and wisdom. Nepakka means wisdom. Chirakatampi Chirabhasitampi Sarita Anusarita. So whatever the deeds done long time ago, either verbal, the bodily, so he can remember them. Chirakatampi chirabhasitampi sarita anussarita. Sati dovariko bhikkave ariya savako akusalam pajahati kusalam bhaveti. So when the gatekeeper of mindfulness is available, so unwholesome qualities are abandoned, wholesome qualities are appreciated, encouraged. Savajjam pajahati anavajjam bhaveti. So he abandons all the unrighteous things and continue the righteous things. Suddhang atthanang pariharati. And he continues to live a very pure mind or pure life. And maintain himself in purity. He possesses this sixth good quality. Then number 7. Just as the rampart in the king's frontier fortress is high and wide, covered over by a coat of plaster, for protecting its inhabitants and for warding off outsiders, so too a noble disciple is wise. He possesses the wisdom that discerns arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. With wisdom as his coat of plaster, the noble disciple abandons the unwholesome and develops the wholesome. Abandon what is blameworthy and develops what is blameless. And maintains himself in purity. He possesses this seventh good quality. Ariyasako panyavahoti. Udayatta gaminiya panyaya samannagato. Ariyaya nibbedikaya. So that means, he has developed vipassana to the level that he can see how various phenomena are arising and passing away. It is not just kind of a book knowledge. The book knowledge is already discussed as another weapon that the noble disciple has. But here the wisdom. Here the wisdom means particularly the kind of a meditative wisdom that one has developed through insight practice. So that's why it is highlighted here. Udayatta gāviniyā paññāya sam ariyāya nibbedikāya samannāgata. Dukkakkaya gāviniyā. So that means, so he has a very penetrative knowledge, penetrative wisdom, and through that wisdom he can see how things are arising and passing away. Panyava sanalepana sampanno bhikkhave ariya savako. That means that Buddha is equalizing with that coat, this coat of plaster. So that is appearing as a kind of protective sheath. Noble disciple abandons the unwholesome and develops the wholesome, abandons what is blameworthy and develops what is blameless, and maintains himself in purity. He possesses this seventh good quality. So those are the seven good qualities that Buddha mentioned, and then actually he keeps on explaining about the four kinds of foods. So that is the four the jhanas, and we'll discuss that on next week. So with that, I like to conclude today's sutta teaching session. Now I like to open the session for questions.
Was there a question there, Bhante?
Still no question. So they may feel sleepy today.
I thought I heard something in the background, so that's why I wasn't sure.
You have a question? Yeah.
I guess if you could say some things about the developing sadha or faith, because I think, you know, as perhaps this is just my perception as a Westerner.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Westerners, you know, nowadays, especially with like religion and spiritual paths, they want to see everything. They want to perhaps, you know, and just people in general maybe, but I think Westerners nowadays, again, this might be my perception as a Westerner, they want to see everything, like, you know, oh, I want to see this like right in front of my eyes, you know, what's this rebirth stuff, like what's all this, you know, and it's like, how do I know I can be like awakened, and you know, they have this doubt. And, you know, just how would you, could you say some things about perhaps developing sadha or faith, like what you can do to continuously cultivate that sadha or faith?
Yeah, that is something, very interesting question. So, because basically, now we as Sri Lankans, we are born with kind of a Buddhist environment, and basically, so it may be a little easy to develop some amount of faith.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, say the Westerners, they being in the kind of a materialistic society, and sometimes you hear various other beliefs as well, then how to develop faith in Buddha? So it's kind of a little difficult in that sense. But anyway, as you start exploring the teaching, nowadays, I mean, the Buddha's teaching is available, so the faith developed through the teaching is also kind of a very strong faith. Actually, that is where Buddha sometimes mentioned, see Buddha through his teaching. Yo dhammam passati, so mam passati. So, if one understand Buddha's teaching properly, so then Buddha mentioned, okay, he may understand me. He understands the Tathagata. He may understand or develop faith in the Buddha himself. So, basically that is one thing that we can add here. And on the other hand, now, say for example, you have a kind of a disease. And now assume that someone else is sort of suggesting a particular doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So this doctor is good for this particular disease, and he is well maintain a well good reputation. And so basically you need to believe that still, even though still you haven't taken medicine, you still have to maintain some kind of faith. Then only you may approach him, isn't it? I mean, so basically you don't know still whether this doctor is really a kind of the person who is going to treat you and you also get well. Still, it hasn't happened. Still, you are suffering from a particular disease. But why you go and select a particular doctor and going through his medication means that you have some faith on that particular doctor. But the interesting part is that now you are continuing the medication, and later, as a result of the medication, now slowly, suppose that you are getting more and more well and you getting recovered, so you start developing more faith on the doctor. So similar in the Buddha's teaching also, first of all, we have to have some kind of a faith which is not much grounded, not much strong, and you are not yet kind of convinced. But later you start practicing, you start sort of adhering to, say, maybe the moral precepts, and you start developing mindfulness, you start developing certain amount of concentration, you start developing about certain amount of wisdom. So likewise, you get on to the practice. As you are continuing the path, now you start entertaining or start reaping some amount of results. So that further enhances the faith in the Buddha, because right now it is no more a kind of a blind type of faith, rather it is more factual type of faith. So the Buddha's teaching or the faith on the Buddha is therefore not continuously kind of a belief system. Rather, at the beginning, yes, true, you have to little believe, but later you can verify what you have believed. So all these things that Buddha mentioned, teachings, etc., you can put into practice, and then slowly you can understand, I mean, their truthfulness or their practicality or their value, you can slowly start understanding. So as you are continuing like that, now say for example, the becoming process. Say how kind of the craving, mind, when it is more endowed with more and more craving, mind go and grasp something and strongly adhere to that, and you are now in a kind of a different state of mentality, kind of a becoming process, bhava, existence. Now, it happens sometimes several times in the day, or sometimes many, many times in a day it happens. Now, something similar happens at the end of the life also, when you are passing in this life. So it is not that your mind completely abandons everything, rather it go and grasp another thing, and you being reborn to that state. So what you are experiencing in a more kind of macro level, or rather the micro level, may happen at the macro level after the death. So in that sense, you can inferentially understand, yes, there is the rebirth. Even though you can't maybe sort of have tangible results in this very life, probably you can maintain kind of an understanding even through your practice, and you can see what is going to happen at the end of this life to your mind. The same mind, the momentum of the mind may continue, and you may be reborn to a new state. You may abandon this material body, but you may get another body as of the mentality, the craving, the grasping, the power is so powerful and it is continuing. And the other thing is, nowadays, and there are enough evidences even for rebirth. You know, there are scientists that they gone to that, there are certain child prodigies, you know. So they are capable of doing some kind of extraordinary things. Say they remember sometimes another language which is not belongs to them. Say for example, say in US, a little child talking in Chinese. So how are you going to explain that? Suppose the surrounding is not Chinese, or the parents are not Chinese, and neighbors are not Chinese, but the child is capable of talking in Chinese. So how are you going to explain that? Now, say sometimes certain young, very young children, they have extraordinary kind of intelligence. They quickly can, say, count numbers or do multiplications, and they quickly give a result. So how are we going to explain that? Now, there may be twins. There may be twins. One child doesn't have such kind of a skill, and the other child has such kind of a skill. So how are you going to explain that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we simply say everything is genetic, so then the both childs have to have, no? Both children have to have, no?
Mm-hmm.
But only one child has that. So how are you going to explain?
Mm-hmm.
So likewise, so there are certain situations we can't find a rational reason through material form.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have to find kind of a something coming from the past lives.
Mm-hmm.
So they are getting something from their past lives. That is why they have this extraordinary skill.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, there are little children who talks about their past lives. And now certain scientists have investigated those cases. They went to those little children and they start investigating those incidents and the places that they are explaining, and they have visited those places and they found enough evidences. Yes, it is true. So likewise, there are many, many evidences nowadays available to believe that, yes, the rebirth is happening. So likewise, I mean, even though sometimes immediately we can't understand these situations, so more investigations help us to understand, so they are really happening.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. I think, you know, the thing about the Buddhist teachings is, ehipasiko, you know, come and see for yourself. So it's not like, you know, you see people in the world, they like, they may be, you can't say for sure, but they may be debating about, you know, is this real or is this real or is this real or this real. The Buddhist teachings is like, just kind of like, don't experience for yourself. Like, don't be getting into these debates. Don't be like looking for external validation. Experience for yourself.
Mm.
And you can have that faith based on personal experience rather than what I think a lot of people may do, which is, oh, did that scientist say that was real, or did that person say that was real? And they look for external kind of
assurance.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
Whereas the Buddhist teachings, I think, is more, I think what the Buddha was teaching is that it's more personal experience.
More personal
You're not
experience.
Looking for external validation so
much.
Mm. Yeah.
Correct. The external validation may be to some extent necessary to convince yourself at the beginning,
yeah.
But you can further verify, and you can sort of firmly establish in your faith as you continue in your practice.
Mm-hmm.
It is no more a belief system in that sense. Rather, you yourself start experiencing it.
Mm-hmm.
So what Buddha mentioned, these qualities, so these skills that we are talking, so if we are continue to develop, so it is you yourself start recognizing their value. You yourself start recognizing their benefit. Then you can understand, yes, what Buddha has mentioned is true.
Mm-hmm.
So more and more then the faith arises, because now you yourself start experiencing them rather than simply thinking that they are there. Because when they are not available with you, then you have to believe. But when things are available with you and you yourself have practiced them, then definitely you can tell another person, yes, I also didn't have, but now I have. Say, for example, concentration, say samadhi. So, and sometimes people say, okay, I don't believe in samadhi, then why don't you practice and see? Now say you can't maintain your attention on couple of breaths, then if someone else is telling, okay, I can maintain my attention on not just couple of breaths, I can even maintain my attention continuously for 30 minutes. So rather than simply believing that, probably you yourself can practice and see whether it is true. So like that, so all these different qualities that Buddha talks actually are very practical, and you yourself can try to develop them, as he said, the ehipassiko, come and see. Come and put me into practice and see. So that's the kind of an invitation the Dhamma does. So rather than simply believing externally, superficially, how about putting them into practice and see whether they are really true? Yeah, it's very practical. Yes, yes.
Okay, I guess I don't want to take up too much time, but I have one more question.
Yeah, yeah, still no question from there.
Oh, okay. So another question I have is, you know, in the Vitaka Santana Sutta, the Buddha, I'm sorry, I can't remember which Nikaya that is.
Majjhima Nikaya, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Buddha is going through different things you can do if you're having like skillful thoughts in your mind, and they're like, maybe you're having some difficulties getting rid of them. You can do this, and then try this, and then try this. I guess, you know, what can people do? Just, I guess, if you would have some advice about, like, you know, if they're having like these unskillful thoughts, if maybe they're sitting in their meditation and, you know, these thoughts are like not going away, and they're just trying to, you know, do different things, but maybe they subside for a little while, then they come back, then they subside, then they come back, and stuff like that. It's kind of like that. What can people do to kind of get rid of these unskillful thoughts? And should they just, like, you know, get up and walk around and then come back to their sitting or something like that?
Yeah, there may be various strategies. So that is why, I mean, we are trying our best to find out a refuge, find out a place to keep the mind. So that place is more kind of a wholesome place. Say, for example, breath, for example. So that is more practical, and that is more something more, say, physical even, we can say. Now, the thought is not kind of physical thing, but the breath is kind of a physical gross thing, which is happening right now. So one option is, now thoughts are going on, yes, true, but immediately I can't fight with them. So the alternative approach is let the thoughts carry on, but time to time I am diverting my attention, focusing my attention to breathing. So more you are successful in that, thoughts become kind of weaker and weaker, because thoughts become stronger and stronger only when we start feeding them, we being deluded by them, and we are sort of promoting them, and we being delighted by them. But the moment you diverting your attention to breathing or rising and falling or your steps or whatever the physical thing, now I am talking more onto the beginner's point of view. So more you are paying attention to these physical things, and you are simply being aware of them, you are not thinking about them. I mean, say rising and falling is happening at the abdomen, and you start feeling that. And you start giving more prominence to that feeling, physical sensation. You start prominence to that. So more your attention being located there, so this whatever the rumination or whatever the wandering thoughts, so they don't have enough energy to continue, because you are not feeding them. You are not being delighted by them. You are not supporting them. So ultimately they become weaker and weaker. They now start like background thoughts. Previously they have actually come to the front of your mind and they start controlling you. But now they can't control. They are very much like background thoughts, and you simply capable of maintaining whatever the attention, the mindfulness, by means of whatever the object, primary object that you have kept in front. So therefore the first option, the advice is that to maintain the primary object, give more prominence to primary object as much as possible, associate the primary object. But later actually all these things are changed once you have mindfulness, once you are capable of handling things, then you can even look at the thoughts, then even you can confront the thoughts, but maintaining kind of a distance, because you are not being carried away by thoughts. Because you already have established mindfulness at that level. But before that, you don't have that much of a capacity. So then you need to maintain kind of a protective measure, just to divert your attention more into the ongoing or the present moment physical phenomena. So that helps to avoid all these proliferations.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Not that we need science to prove what the Buddha said, but you know, our mind can't do two different, completely different things. Like we can't be aware of thinking and a physical sensation going on at the same time. So if we're focused on the thinking, we'll be involved in thinking. If we're focused on the physical aspect, then the thinking is dropped.
Dropped.
Can't be both.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to add that scientists, you know, can see that now. They can see how the brain can't do both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But we can see it from experience too.
They can't do what at the same
time? The mind can't be. The brain can't function in thinking and at the same time be focused on something like sensations.
The brain can't.
It cannot do that because it's two different locations of the brain that are active.
Mm.
If you're involved with thinking, that's one location of the brain that becomes active.
Yeah.
But if you're focused on sensations, that's another location of the brain.
Yeah. So they can't function at the same time.
Either one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, I think Sayadaw Uganya from the Mao tradition was saying something similar to that when I saw him in California.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was saying something like, yeah, you know, the mind is something related to that, you know, like the thinking, you're trying to think at the same time is stilling the mind, and it's just kind of like a friction.
Contradicting.
It's like friction.
Friction. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And since most of our thoughts are defiled,
mm-hmm.
most of our thoughts are fed by some defilement.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be sure that don't feed the wolf, you know, don't
mm-hmm.
let the wolf grow. Feed the wholesome quality of just the body and sensations or just knowing reality.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to just see, are you going to talk about the four foods? Is that the jhanas?
Yeah, that is what mentioned here. Mm-hmm. So probably we may discuss that next week.
Okay, so
Okay, there is one written question. It says, Dear Bhante, are meditators supposed to develop these seven qualities mentioned in their regular practice without waiting for achieving jhanas as given in the sutta?
Interesting. So I think very much like, now say for example, mindfulness. So mindfulness is explained as a kind of a quality. But without that quality, you can't develop the jhanas. So therefore, we can say to some extent, so these qualities, what Buddha mentioned, the seven qualities, what Buddha mentioned, are very much like prerequisites to develop jhana. So if we have proper setting through these seven qualities, so then you are maintaining kind of a very good ground or kind of a fertile ground to develop jhana. Because say for example, if you don't have these seven qualities, say you don't have mental, the faith you don't have, so you don't have moral shame, you don't have moral dread, and say you don't have mindfulness, you don't know much about the teaching, and again there is no energy available, and again there is no wisdom, then of course you can't have jhana. Because in order to have jhana, faith is compulsory. Because even in the samatha practice, say faith is a must to have jhana. So without faith, you can't take the mind to the level of a jhana. And again, without enough energy, you are not practicing. Without mindfulness, you are not capable of developing concentration. So therefore, I think your question is valid. So therefore, these seven qualities that Buddha mentioned are very much like prerequisites in order to develop jhana. Are you there?
In case we have anyone that's new joining us for the first time, if you have questions, you can raise your hand or you can also send them through the chat. Bhante, I guess I was assuming maybe there's some sequence to these seven qualities, right? Starting with faith as that foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm quite surprised that mindfulness and the gatekeeper isn't mentioned until like the sixth quality.
Mm-hmm. Not the sixth. I think it is, correct. You are correct. It's the sixth. Yes, yes. Hmm. So in that sense, actually, Buddha give some prominence to the ethics. Now that is say what you call as the moral shame, moral dread. So that is being explained at early stages, and again the faith and the faith explained as the first quality. So that indicates kind of a path. But interestingly, you know that there is another sutta, Sati Sampajanya Sutta. Sati Sampajanya Sutta explains differently, where Buddha starts with Sati Sampajanya, and as a result of one having Sati Sampajanya, then one has moral shame and moral dread. So that is also available. Probably you can remember that is the very first sutta we discuss, I think, in this sutta teaching session series. So there Buddha mentioned, if one has mindfulness and clear comprehension, as a result of that, one going to have moral shame and moral dread. When one has moral shame and moral dread, then one is careful about one's bodily conduct, verbal conduct, mental conduct. So that means he has the three holes, the wholesome type of the bodily, verbal and mental conduct. So likewise, there's another alternative approach is also there. So even if one starts developing mindfulness as his initial practice, so slowly the other good qualities that we are talking here starts coming in, starts joining into the path. So you can't develop mindfulness alone. You may start developing mindfulness alone, but slowly it will invite the all other necessary qualities. You can't maintain or you can't develop mindfulness without the support of those qualities. So they are going hand in hand, very much like kind of a group of friends. They are going hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wonder if perhaps the differences in sequence in like the different suttas is maybe addressing kind of different
characters. Maybe.
For example, in this sutta, the Buddha used the specific simile of a fortress.
Mm.
So a fortress is there to more so protect against enemy invasions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
maybe perhaps, you know, in order to protect from, let's say, unwholesome qualities and development of those, that's why we need to start with the faith and then the we can say ethics or maybe the silas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then going on to others.
Yeah, and on the other hand, Jennifer, I think sometimes when Buddha preaches Dhamma, probably he see the context. Now, as you rightly mentioned, so currently assume the context is the protecting already developed qualities or protecting one's mind. So that is the theme of the talk. Then he talks in that angle. Suppose in the Sati Sampajanya Sutta, maybe the theme is a little different. So he starts with mindfulness and clear comprehension, and then he show how it starts developing moral shame and moral dread and ethics and all these things, and all those also come into the picture. So different approaches are available, but ultimately it's a kind of a group or collection of various good wholesome qualities, ultimately sort of winning. One may start from one end, but it slowly gathers all the other necessary good qualities also. Yeah, yeah. Okay, if there is no any other question, then we can wind up today's session, and we can probably discuss the last part, that is the four foods, next week. And today also we were able to discuss the one sutta coming from Anguttara Nikaya, available in the Anguttara Nikaya this Nagaropama Sutta, and we were able to discuss that and as well as have a little discussion based on that sutta. And with that, we were able to accumulate some merits, and we share these merits with all the past relatives, with all the celestial beings, and whoever in need of merits. And we wish these merits help us also to attain path, fruition, nibbana. While keeping these good wishes in our mind, let's recite the traditional verses. Ettavata ca amhehi sambatam punya sampadam sambe deva anumodantu sambha sampatti siddhiya. Ettavata ca amhehi sambatam punya sampadam sambe bhuta anumodantu sambha sampatti siddhiya. Ettavata ca amhehi sambatam punya sampadam sambe satta anumodantu sambha sampatti siddhiya. Akasattha ca bhummatta devanaga mahiddhika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakkantu sasanam. Akasattha ca bhummatta devanaga mahiddhika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakkantu desanam. Akasattha ca bhummatta devanaga mahiddhika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakkantu mam param. Idam vo jnatinam hotu sukhita hontu jnatayo.
Idam vo jnatinam hotu
sukhita hontu jnatayo. Idam vo jnatinam hotu sukhita hontu jnatayo. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo satam samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina
punya kammena
mame bala samagamo satam samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo satam samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.